Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal podcast. I'm Mohsin Subhani, trainee editor at UEG Journal and a hepatologist based at Nottingham University Hospitals.
And I'm Maria Manuela Espinho, trainee editor at UEG Journal and gastroenterologist based in Porto, Portugal.
Today, we are diving into a major new consensus statement on key performance indicator for upper gastroenterology endoscopy aimed at reducing post-endoscopy upper GI cancers. And we are delighted to be joined by two of the lead authors, Dr. Umar Kamran, who is a consultant gastroenterologist and advanced HPB endoscopist at Newcastle University Hospital, and Dr. Nigel Trudgill, who is consultant gastroenterologist at Sandwell and West Birmingham, NHS Trust and honorary professor at University of Birmingham. He also shares a leading role in BSG for Upper GI Cancer Committee and National Pancreatic Cancer Audit Lead Committee as well, and been a lead author in the current presentation.
Thank you both for joining us today. This is a hugely important paper because, as we all know, endoscopy is a gold standard for diagnosing upper GI cancers, yet we still see cancers being missed.
Umar, perhaps you can set the scene for us. When we say key performance indicators in endoscopy, what we mean and why was there such a need to develop a consensus on them?
Thank you, Mohsin, Maria, and Eugene for invitation. So key performance indicators are the measures that are used to assess the performance of a service or aspects of the service. There are other terminologies which have been used in literature, such as quality measures or quality indicators. Evidence-based key performance measures provide endoscopists and the endoscopy units with a framework and a benchmark against which they can assess their service, and their services and the performance can be compared with other services as well. So we know that there are well-established key performance indicators for colonoscopy, which have led to a significant improvement in the quality of colonoscopy in the UK and a reduction in post-colonoscopy colorectal cancer rate. Such efforts are required for upper GI endoscopy as well. We know that various endoscopy societies have proposed key performance measures or KPIs around 6 to 8 years ago, but quality of evidence available at that time was considered to be quite poor. So in this project, which was funded by National Institute for Health and Care Research in the UK, we updated the evidence and we involved key stakeholders, including patients, their representatives, and clinicians to develop a consensus. And the main objective was to identify the most important measures, which will not only provide guidance to clinicians, but should also be focus of future quality improvement efforts.
So, Nigel, you have done a lot of work on post-endoscopy GI cancer or PELGIC. Could you talk us through how this project came about and how the journey towards the consensus actually started?
Yes, Manuela. So post-endoscopy upper GI cancer, or PELGIC, we call it, is a very bad event for patients, their relatives, and also for endoscopists as well, because we all want to do a good job when we do endoscopy and not miss cancer or not miss early cancer and prevent patients having curative treatment. So one of the difficulties of upper GI endoscopy is we lack KPIs like adenoma detection or polyp detection, which is the great thing that we can use in colonoscopy. And so we wanted to develop consensus on an agreed set of KPIs, uniquely in this case using patients' views as well, as to what they thought were important factors to choose to measure to try to reduce the rate of PELGIC in future. And we decided to undertake a consensus process with patients and a wide variety of clinicians to agree what we thought the most important KPIs would be to implement in future to reduce PELGIC.
Coming back to the paper itself, could you walk our listeners through how this work was conducted? What was the process to arrive at the final indicators?
So we employed a modified nominal group technique to develop this consensus. This robust approach facilitates generation and prioritization of ideas from a diverse group of participants, ensuring a democratic and inclusive process. This was conducted in the form of two online workshops, moderated by James Lind Alliance facilitators. The participants included 14 clinicians, including consultant gastroenterologists, upper GI surgeons, and trainees, 3 nurse and clinical endoscopists, 2 upper GI cancer nurse specialists, 8 patients, 3 carers, and 3 representatives from patient support group, and 4 observers. So quite very diverse group of participants. So we potential indicators were identified in the first 3 phases of this NIHR project, which included umbrella systematic review, where we looked at all the published literature and the evidence for our potential KPIs. And then we analyzed the National Cancer Registry database for about 99,000 patients who were diagnosed with upper GI cancer in the UK. And in the following phase, we analyzed endoscopy practices in the UK using National Endoscopy Database. So this is how we developed the evidence for potential KPIs. And then we categorized these KPIs as endoscopist or procedure-related or provider-related. Then summary of evidence and proposed minimum standards were shared with the participants for the workshops in advance. So in each workshop, the participants were divided into 3 small groups with balanced clinician and patient or their relative representation. The first workshop focused on identifying candidate KPIs. The participants were asked to provide their opinion on the list of potential KPIs, and this was followed by a ranking exercise within each of these groups. In the second workshop, the participants confirmed the ranking of the KPIs, and then the geometric mean was calculated, and the top 10 scoring KPIs were considered as major indicators, and remaining ones were considered as minor indicators.
And thinking about implementation, how do you see these recommendations influencing practice across different centers? Is this about changing individual behavior, or is it more at the system and provider level?
There are things for endoscopy units to do in terms of less intense lists, dedicated lists for high-risk conditions, and monitoring their Puget rates and looking at why cancer might be missed. But then individual endoscopists have a responsibility as well to ensure the quality of their own procedures and they're doing sufficient to maintain their standards. And then finally, there are things we haven't mentioned around administration and booking of procedures and management of pathology within units that are also important that we didn't consider because we were just talking about endoscopy. But when people address all these things, they'll raise standards of upper GI endoscopy, I'm sure.
Great, Omar and Nigel. So before we wrap up, could I ask each of you to share one takeaway message for our listeners, whether they are trainees or practicing endoscopists or policymakers?
What I would mention, and I think all of us know already, that the index endoscopy, the first endoscopy which patients have, is the most important procedure they're going to have in this patient. So we need to make every possible effort, both at the endoscopist and the unit level, to provide the best quality procedure to maximize the chances that we detect cancer early stage so that we can cure it. Unfortunately, as we know that the prognosis of upper GI cancer is not great, and only because they are usually diagnosed at advanced stage. So if we can detect the cancer at early stage by providing the highest quality endoscopy, which patients deserve, then that is the best thing that we can do for our patients.
Well, I think the key thing for me is that I've been interested for many years in post-endoscopy upper GI cancer or potentially missed cancer. And these are bad experiences for patients and for endoscopists as well, because we all like to do a good job. And the key thing is we must learn from them. And there are some simple things that you can learn from them. And in the UK, for instance, we have difficulties recognizing early squamous cancer. And that's the most commonly missed cancer during endoscopy. And so if you learn what early squamous cancer looks like from looking at images and you use narrowband or blue light endoscopy routinely when you're examining the esophagus, you'll give yourself the best chance of finding that particular kind of missed cancer that's a very common missed cancer. And there are other examples like that, very simple things we can do to improve the quality of the endoscopies we do.
Fantastic. Omar and Nigel, thank you very much for being with us today. And congratulations again on this important work. And we hope that more publications coming from your side, and hopefully we can really improve the quality of care in endoscopy.
So now we will dive into a brand new paper from UAG Journal titled Rifaximin A in Patients with Recurrent Episodes of Hepatic Encephalopathy Due to Cirrhosis. This study comes from Dr. Dorn and colleagues, who bring us fresh data on a problem every hepatologist wrestles with. Indeed, around 40% of patients with cirrhosis demonstrate overt hepatic encephalopathy at any given time point.
Yes, and when we talk about hepatic encephalopathy, it's a dreadful complication of cirrhosis, which can make a patient very confused and muddled up. And they can have recurrent episodes, which is not only scary to the patient, but also to their families, and also very costly for our healthcare systems.
Exactly. And rifaximin alpha has been around for a while. But what this team wanted to clarify is, what's the real-world effectiveness of rifaximin when patients already have multiple episodes of hepatic encephalopathy?
So let's talk the design. This was a prospective observational multi-center study across the Europe. They included over 5,000 patients with underlying cirrhosis who had experience of hepatic encephalopathy at least at two different occasions within 6 months, and they were started on rifaximin alpha on top of standard care, and which is usually lactulose.
Right, and then they followed these patients over 24 months, recording outcomes like recurrence, HE episodes, hospitalizations, and survival.
And here is the punchline. Rifaximin alpha was associated with a sustained reduction in hepatic encephalopathy recurrence, hospitalization, and in fact, the risk of having another episode of hepatic encephalopathy dropped substantially once patients were on rifaximin alpha.
Yes, and plus, patients who responded well in the first 6 months tended to keep doing well over the two-year follow-up. It's like rifaximin quickly shows you who is going to benefit and those whose benefits last.
Clinically, that's huge, because preventing hepatic recurrence is not just about keeping people out of hospital. It is about preventing and improving quality of life and reducing the burden on caregivers and honestly giving patients some dignity back.
Well said. And the safety profile was reassuring too. No new safety signals beyond what we already know about rifaximin have been shown.
Great. I think practical takeaway is that if you got a patient with cirrhosis who's having recurrent hepatic encephalopathy, keep in mind that rifaximin alpha can be a mainstay of treatment in addition to standard of care, which is usually lactulose.
Absolutely. And let's not forget the economic side. Fewer hospitalizations mean less strain on healthcare budgets. Though, to be fair, rifaximin isn't exactly sold at the price of, well, peanuts.
True, but if it keeps patients at home and out of hospitals, then we may be able to say it's worth every peanut.
Well, nicely put. So to wrap up, Dorn et al. Shown that in real-world European practice, rifaximin alpha keeps working over time, reducing recurrent HE episodes, hospitalizations, and supporting long-term outcomes in cirrhosis patients.
And that's a win for the patient, caregivers, healthcare, and clinicians alike.
And now let's move to a brand new set of guidelines published in UEGJ. Entitled Esophageal and Oropharyngeal Dysphagia Clinical Recommendations, written by a very diverse team of experts working under the umbrella of UEG and the European Society for Gastroenterology and Motility.
Dysphagia corresponding to difficulty in swallowing is actually very common. It affects quality of life, nutrition, and can even lead to serious complications like aspiration pneumonia. So having clear evidence-based recommendation really matters both for gastroenterologists and for multidisciplinary teams.
Exactly. And what's important here is that this is one of the first comprehensive European guideline efforts that covers both oropharyngeal and esophageal dysphagia together, bridging gaps between gastroenterology, ENT, speech therapy, and neurology.
Great. So let's summarize what the panel did. They systematically reviewed literature and then used a structured consensus process to generate 61 recommendations across the diagnosis, management, and follow-up dysphagia. These were graded based on evidence strength and expert agreement.
On the diagnostic side, they stressed the importance of a stepwise approach. History and bedside follow screening, then instrumental tests like video fluoroscopy, fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, and high-resolution manometry when needed. High-resolution manometry is indeed gold standard, supported by Chicago classification. And also, while high-resolution manometry characterizes pressure and motility patterns, and a flip allows providing functional and mechanical insights into lumen geometry and compliance, giving clinicians complementary information for diagnosing and understanding dysphagia. And also importantly, they emphasize that no single test is perfect and we indeed need complementary assessments frequently.
That's nicely put, Manuela. And on the treatment, the guidelines highlight a MDT approach, more toward personalized care, such as for oropharyngeal dysphagia, speech and language therapy remain the main stay of treatment, while for oropharyngeal dysphagia, intervention depends upon underlying cause, from PPI in reflux disease to dilatation and stricture and to neuroendoscopic or surgical option in motility disorders.
Yes, and they also stress nutritional support and monitoring because malnutrition and dehydration are huge, often overlooked risks in these patients. And let's not forget, preventing aspiration, of course, saves lives.
And clinically, this is very relevant. As you know, dysphagia is often under-recognized. Patient may just say food sticks or I cough up when I drink water. And unless we ask the right question, we miss it. A correct medical history is crucial when evaluating dysphagia and differentiating oropharyngeal from esophageal dysphagia. This distinction helps determine the appropriate diagnosis technique.
Yes, these recommendations should help clinicians identify and manage dysphagia earlier. I like also that the panel also called for better collaboration across specialties, gastroenterologists, ENT specialists, neurologists, dietitians, speech therapists. It really takes a village to manage dysphagia well.
Absolutely. The key takeaway is dysphagia is common, serious, but treatable. These newer European recommendations give us a solid roadmap to improve diagnosis, treatment, and long-term care. So if you see patient who cough while drinking or while eating certain foods, don't ignore it. With these guidelines, we now have a better toolkit to help them. Let's move on to the next article. We will be talking about what challenges we face while implementing AI in endoscopy. So this is a real-world imaging data on Barrett neoplasia, which was published in UEG Journal by MR Jung and colleagues and on behalf of Bones AI Consortium. They looked at this particular, how real-world imaging impacts the performance of AI in endoscopy world.
Yes, and this is such an important point. AI systems are often developed using high-quality images from expert centers, but that's not what we see in everyday clinical practice. In community hospitals, image quality is much more variable, with issues like suboptimal mucosal cleaning or poor esophageal expansion. And that can really affect how well AI performs, of course.
And in terms of methodology, author built a computer-aided detection system trained on just over 1,000 high-quality images from over 350 patients with Barrett esophagus. They then tested it on three independent sets of over 100 patients each, representing high, moderate, and low-quality images, much closer to what we actually encounter in routine care.
Yes, and the results were indeed striking. On the high quality test set, the system performed well with an area under the curve of 83% and a sensitivity of 85%. But of course, performance dropped significantly when lower quality image set was used, with sensitivity falling to 62% with moderate quality images and just 47% on the low quality set. And of course, we have to assume that this is a huge decline.
Yes, but Manuela, you know that study also discussed different ways how AI can be trained and improve the reading of the low-quality images. This by including more diverse training data, using domain-specific pre-training, and optimizing models' architecture. They managed to boost the performance of their model with these strategies. The system achieved actually AUC above 90% for high and moderate quality images, and sensitivity rose up to 78% even on the low quality sets by using these different type of strategies.
Yes, so the key message is that AIs trained only in pristine expert center data may not translate well to everyday practice. However, with smarter training strategies, we can improve generalizability and make these tools much more reliable for our real-world endoscopy settings.
Exactly. So what are the takeaway points from this work? First, endoscopy AI system can lose up to half of their sensitivity when exposed to low-quality real-world data. Secondly, robustness can be improved by applying different strategies, including training the model in diverse settings. And third, building and validating AI in real world is the way forward if we want to implement these practices in real world endoscopy.
And if we can achieve that, of course, AI can become the real game changer in Barrett's surveillance and beyond.
Great. And now it's time for our last paper, and we will move to the paper. The title sounds a bit painful, but just to say, endoscopy-related musculoskeletal injuries, a systematic review and meta-analysis on prevalence, risk factor, and prevention. And interestingly, proud to say that Manuela is a co-author in this systematic review.
Yeah, that's right. This study published in the UEG journal is led by Raquel Oliveira and other colleagues from my wonderful country, Portugal, but also from colleagues in Germany and beyond. And it's all about what happens to the doctors who spend their days holding scopes, twisting dials, and leaning over monitors.
Excellent, Manuela. I think this is very caring work and timely. What exactly it is, the endoscopists save patients from cancer and bleeding, but they often end up having muscular injuries like sore thumbs, sore backs, stiff necks, and this all impact actually their quality of life. The team pulled together data from 30 studies covering more than 7,000 endoscopists worldwide, looking into endoscopy-related musculoskeletal injuries.
And the numbers are, well, eye-watering. About 63% of endoscopists develop MSK injuries at some point during their career. And the most common trouble spots are hands, thumbs, lower back, and neck. Basically, the entire please don't fail me now zone.
Manuela, that's terrible. That's almost two-thirds of the endoscopist. Now imagine when you're explaining to a patient that your colon looks fine, but I'm sorry to say, my back is hurting and my thumb is numb now.
And it's not random. Risk factors included high procedure volumes, many years in practice, and being female. Interestingly, a lot of endoscopists don't really treat their injuries properly. Some take painkillers, some do a bit of physical therapy, but only about 14% take sick leave. Many just push through, which isn't exactly a long-term solution.
Right, but the study also highlights some promising prevention steps, which are important to know, like adjusting monitor and table height, reducing case numbers per session, and importantly, training in ergonomics. Because while the scope have barely changed since 1980s, our awareness of workplace health definitely should.
Yeah. At least those are reassuring news. And clinically this matters because endoscopies are indeed, a limited resource. If they are in burnout physically, it shortens careers, and of course, in the end, it affects patients' care. So protecting the doctor's muscles is really about sustaining the service for our patients.
So is it right to say that endoscopy saves life, but it shouldn't ruin people's performing endoscopy? If you're an endoscopist, maybe consider that stretching the routine, and if you're designing scopes, please a little ergonomic love would not hurt. And also taking up healthy lifestyle measures, and also the measures been discussed in the paper that can improve your performance and also reduce the risk of MSK-related injuries.
Yes. So that's all for today. Thank you very much for listening to us, and we look forward to see you next time.
Thank you very much to listeners. Thanks for staying with us. But don't forget to like, subscribe, and share, and keep questioning evidence until the next episode.